You're listening to Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. We're awaiting a speech from Washington, George Mason University, where President-elect Barack Obama is expected to fill in some of the details of his plan, his economic recovery plan. He is coming on to the stage there at George Washington University, and as he begins to speak, we will take him live. In the meantime here, we're going to go to Charles Franklin for a quick read on some of the political challenges that Barack Obama may face in getting his plan through Congress. Professor Franklin, good to have you here.
Good to be here.
I should say you teach political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Tell me, I'm reading this morning about some of the opposition that is already building in Congress. What will the Obama team be looking out for as they try to push this plan through?
Well, I think the thing we've seen so far is that President-elect Obama has been really pushing the consequences of not acting, that if we don't act now and act forcefully, things will be much worse. And I think that's critical to his political problem because people might vote against the plan on budget reasons, on it's directed at the wrong places and so on. I don't think anyone wants to vote for a depression. And so I think the real trick here is, can Obama convince the public and convince members of Congress that voting against this plan is, in effect, voting for a worse recession? Then the devil, of course, is always in the details. And one of the things that people are looking forward to today in this speech is, will he start to present some of the details instead of the broad overview of the plan?
I wonder, Professor, if he's actually going to talk about the specific number, because he was asked about that yesterday. And I think there is perhaps a difference psychologically if you're talking about billions or trillions.
I presume that even there we have a little bit of a psychological barrier between billions and trillions. It used to be millions and billions were the big ones. Now we're moved it up by 1,000. I think the real issue for him is in the talks he did yesterday and the interview he gave, he was pretty clear that he wanted to hold down the price with the understanding that the legislative process would probably increase the price. And I think that's politically a good move from him. If he can talk about a $700 billion plan and then let it be Congress that pushes it up around $1 trillion, I think that's a little better for him, and it's better for him in terms of getting congressional support for a bill in which the members of Congress themselves have pushed up the money.
Well, is it better, though, if he is also trying on one hand to talk about his recovery plan and on the other hand to talk about fiscal responsibility? I noticed that his team has been saying there will be no earmarks in this bill. So if they come out with something, you know, where Congress has added another billion or more of spending, isn't it hard to make the argument that he's got a handle on fiscal responsibility as well, even as we spend these huge amounts of money?
Yeah, there's a little disconnect between talking about trillion-dollar deficits for the foreseeable future and at the same time talking about fiscal responsibility. On the other hand, I think there's large agreement across the policy spectrum, with some exceptions, that large government intervention is necessary. Exactly how large and exactly how is part of the question. So I think as a political strategy, it makes sense for him to talk about fiscal discipline and looking beyond the bailout period and the Recovery Act period and into more normal times down the road. Exactly where that is remains undecided. But I think it's an interesting political move on his part to sound a bit like a fiscal conservative on that score, while at the same time saying these very large deficits are part of the emergency measures that we have to take. That's a fine distinction. We'll see how well he can pull it off.
Charles, do you think he's got the American people with him, even the voters who did not support him in the election?
The best current polling data is that he does. Certainly, he's had some of the highest or the highest ratings during the transition period that any recent transition has had. And there's broad support for some kind of recovery program. Now, again, it's easy to support that in the abstract. The last hour, that your guests were doing a great job of talking about some of those details, And the devil that goes there, is this kind of tax break to business better, or is it worse?
Right.
Is direct payments to taxpayers better, or is some other kind of method better? So I think we'll certainly get bogged down in those deep details over the next couple of months. I think the biggest issue for the president-elect is, can he avoid having this bogged down in Congress so that it takes a long time to pass, or it becomes a Christmas tree that individuals, members start hanging decorations on? His emphasis yesterday about not being earmarks or pork barrel projects sounds good. It sounds like John McCain, ironically enough. But on the other hand, those kinds of special considerations for members is one of the, you know, lubricants that eases the legislative process. So we'll see how this plays out.
We're going to get some unemployment numbers here at the end of the week. And we have just, it's been a steady stream of negative economic news. Do you think he has been adept in still being able to stand aside from having some responsibility for what's going on in the economy, but being able to step up and say, but I'm going to fix it? Right. Is he managing that well?
And I think he is, and I think historically presidents have had on the order of 6 to 10 months before the state of the economy becomes a drag on their administration as their responsibility. In many ways, bad unemployment numbers and consumer pessimism about the economy, which is near an all-time low right now, are Obama's best friends because they drive home the urgency of the situation. If we had a month or two of relatively optimistic news, that would undercut the notion that this is really urgent and has to be done. Now, for better or worse, it certainly doesn't look like there's good economic news on the horizon anytime soon.
Well, that's interesting.
So I don't
hear
think
you.
That'll be a problem for him. But it's the urgency of the situation that has made members of Congress willing to even contemplate trillion-dollar deficits.
That is interesting to hear you say that. So in some odd twist here, the worse the news gets, the better the argument for doing something as massive as he wants to do.
I think that's right. Look, on the auto bailout bill, 150 Republicans in the House voted against it, 32 voted for it.
Mm-hmm.
Not, I believe, because 150 Republicans want to see an end to the U.S. auto industry, but because it was ambiguous whether this bailout of the auto industry was going to work and whether it was really necessary. In the same way that the Obama Economic Recovery Plan is going to involve huge amounts of money, it's going to be successful because members of Congress realize and are confronted with a situation in which they just can't credibly say it's better for us to do nothing or it's better for us to stand aside. And so in that sense, I think the real economic difficulties, the rising unemployment rate and so on, is the Obama administration's friend for getting passage of this.
Charles Franklin is spending a few moments with me here as we await the economic recovery speech that President-elect Barack Obama is due to give this hour from George Mason University in Washington. I'm looking at a live picture here on CNN. He's got a sizable crowd gathered there at the university and awaiting the arrival of the president-elect. As I said in the introduction here, and we talked about last hour, we've gotten some indications, some clues about some of the things that the team and the president-elect have put together for their economic recovery plan. But today he is expected to really fill in a lot of the specifics, talking with Charles Franklin about whether we'll actually hear a number. How large is this economic recovery package going to be? And we're talking about some of the political implications of getting it through Congress. Charles Franklin, political scientist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. As Barack Obama appears, we will then go live to listen into the speech. You mentioned the auto bailout, Charles. Boy, we heard that was all over the news in early December. We hear nothing about that except some very negative numbers coming out of Detroit. Is that dead? Any kind of a bailout for the auto industry dead?
Well, you know, President Bush approved using money from the earlier bailout to tide them over. But we're going to see this hit a peak again in March when that funding runs out. And at that point, will there in fact be another vote to aid the industry or not. I think what happened at the end of 2008 just bought the auto industry a little bit of time and bought the political world a little bit of time to consider what to do on this.
Well, what do you think happens in March then when it comes up again?
I think the difficulty was that the auto industry did a horrible job of selling the necessity and that they would be responsible with the money and actually use it to address fundamental issues of the auto industry. And that failure made it particularly easy for opposition to go ahead and vote against it because the auto industry's case was not convincing. In this way, there's a parallel between the Obama economic plan and the auto industry. If the case is not made convincing for such extraordinary expenditures, it's very easy for opposition to vote against it as simply irresponsible. It's when the case is made compelling and convincingly, and in Obama's case, responsibly, with this emphasis on we're going to spend money on things that work, we're not going to spend money on things that don't work, and we're going to be transparent about where and how much is spent on what, that he starts to move that part of the plan to being convincing. That was the thing that the auto executives utterly failed to do in their first appearance before Congress and largely failed to do in the second. And partly it reflects, of course, the difficulties the auto industry has between its workers, its capital, and its entrenched, managers.
So maybe there's a little more coordination in March between where the administration is at and where Congress is at, and so the executives can come back and be more convincing.
Well, who knows what's going to happen? The other thing that's going to happen is that the auto industry now and the auto union, the UAW, will be dealing with a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president who, in a perverse way, may be more beholden to that industry or those workers, but also are in a better position to push for concessions that a Republican administration, especially as weak as President Bush has been at the end of his term, has been unable to do. I don't think very many auto industry analysts believe that the current UAW contract can continue if the auto industry is going to be competitive, but that is a very bitter pill for union workers to accept.
If you're listening in this morning and saying, what's going on? I don't hear Mid-Morning taking any calls. What are they doing? We're awaiting a speech by President-elect Barack Obama. He's running, well, now about 12 minutes late, was due to appear at 10 o'clock straight up at George Mason University, where he is going to fill in some of the details, outline his economic recovery plan. If you listened in yesterday and you heard National Public Radio awaiting his press conference, I think, Charles, we're getting a sense that this may not be a president who is always on time, because he was like 20 minutes late yesterday, too.
That's right. Well, this used to be President Clinton's
I remember.
Ability to show up an hour late for everything. The Obama folks hadn't quite been that bad, but yesterday and now today, it's too bad I can't sing or dance on the radio.
Oh, and you don't need to. Don't worry about that. So to let our audience know here, when the president-elect appears and gets ready to speak, we'll go live to Washington to listen in for that. At the moment, we're talking with Charles Franklin about some of the challenges that may await the Obama team as they try to get this massive, and we don't have the actual number yet, on the recovery plan through Congress. And we're talking about some of the hiccups maybe on the political landscape about that. Charles, one thing I do want to note here is there are confirmation hearings already scheduled for some of Barack Obama's picks for his cabinet. Secretary of State Senator Hillary Clinton is going to go before Congress next Tuesday.
That's
for
right.
A confirmation hearing on Secretary of State. They are moving so quickly.
That's right. And Tom Daschle for Health and Human Services is doing confirmation hearings today, right now as we speak. This is the combination of the Obama team having put these nominees in place.
Charles,
very early.
I yes. will interrupt, and I hope we'll talk to you a bit later, but
very
thank
good.
You.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Please be seated. Thank you so much. Let me begin by thanking George Mason University for their extraordinary hospitality, and to thank all the great friends, the governors, the mayors who are in attendance here today. Throughout America's history, there have been some years that simply rolled into the next without much notice or fanfare. And then there are the years that come along once in a generation, the kind that mark a clean break from a troubled past and set a new course for our nation. This is one of those years. We start 2009 in the midst of a crisis unlike any we have seen in our lifetime, a crisis that has only deepened over the last few weeks. Nearly 2 million jobs have been now lost, and on Friday we're likely to learn that we lost more jobs last year than at any time since World War II. Just in the past year, another 2.8 million Americans who want and need full-time work have had to settle for part-time jobs. Manufacturing has hit a 28-year low. Many businesses cannot borrow or make payroll. Many families cannot pay their bills or their mortgage. Many workers are watching their life savings disappear. And many, many Americans are both anxious and uncertain of what the future will hold. Now, I don't believe it's too late to change course, but it will be if we don't take dramatic action as soon as possible. If nothing is done, this recession could linger for years. The unemployment rate could reach double digits. Our economy could fall $1 trillion short of its full capacity, which translates into more than $12,000 in lost income for a family of four. We could lose a generation of potential and promise as more young Americans are forced to forego dreams of college or the chance to train for the jobs of the future. And our nation could lose the competitive edge that has served as a foundation for our strength and our standing in the world. In short, a bad situation could become dramatically worse. This crisis did not happen solely by some accident of history or normal turn of the business cycle, and we won't get out of it by simply waiting for a better day to come or relying on the worn-out dogmas of the past. We arrived at this point due to an era of profound irresponsibility that stretched from corporate boardrooms to the halls of power in Washington, D.C. For years, too many Wall Street executives made imprudent and dangerous decisions, seeking profits with too little regard for risk, too little regulatory scrutiny, and too little accountability. Banks made loans without concern for whether borrowers could repay them, and some borrowers took advantage of cheap credit to take on debt they couldn't afford. Politicians spent taxpayer money without wisdom or discipline, and too often focused on scoring political points instead of problems they were sent here to solve. The result has been a devastating loss of trust and confidence in our economy, our financial markets, and our government. Now, the very fact that this crisis is largely of our own making means that it's not beyond our ability to solve. Our problems are rooted in past mistakes, not our capacity for future greatness. It will take time, perhaps many years, but we can rebuild that lost trust and confidence. We can restore opportunity and prosperity. We should never forget that our workers are still more productive than any on earth. Our universities are still the envy of the world. We are still home to the most brilliant minds, the most creative entrepreneurs, and the most advanced technology and innovation that history has ever known. And we are still the nation that has overcome great fears and improbable odds. If we act with the urgency and seriousness that this moment requires, I know that we can do it again. And that is why I have moved quickly to work with my economic team and leaders of both parties on an American recovery and reinvestment plan that will immediately jumpstart job creation and long-term growth. It's a plan that represents not just new policy, but a whole new approach to meeting our most urgent challenges. For if we hope to end this crisis, we must end the culture of anything goes that helped create it. And this change must begin in Washington. It's time to trade old habits for a new spirit of responsibility. It's time to finally change the ways of Washington so that we can set a new and better course for America. There is no doubt that the cost of this plan will be considerable. It will certainly add to the budget deficit in the short term. But equally certain are the consequences of doing too little or nothing at all. For that will lead to an even greater deficit of jobs, incomes, and confidence in our economy. It is true that we cannot depend on government alone to create jobs or long-term growth. But at this particular moment, only government can provide the short-term boost necessary to lift us from a recession this deep and severe. Only government can break the cycle that are crippling our economy, where a lack of spending leads to lost jobs, which leads to even less spending, where an inability to lend and borrow stops growth and leads to even less credit. That's why we need to act boldly and act now to reverse these cycles. That's why we need to put money in the pockets of the American people, create new jobs, and invest in our future. That's why we need to restart the flow of credit and restore the rules of the road that will ensure a crisis like this never happens again. And this plan must begin today. A plan I am confident will save or create at least 3 million jobs over the next few years. It's not just another public works program. It's a plan that recognizes both the paradox and promise of this moment. The fact that there are millions of Americans trying to find work, even as all around the country there's so much work to be done. And that's why we'll invest in priorities like energy and education, health care, and a new infrastructure that are necessary to keep us strong and competitive in the 21st century. That's why the overwhelming majority of the jobs created will be in the private sector, while our plan will save the public sector jobs of teachers, police officers, firefighters, and others who provide vital services. To finally spark the creation of a clean energy economy, we will double the production of alternative energy in the next 3 years. We will modernize more than 75% of federal buildings and improve the energy efficiency of 2 million American homes, saving consumers and taxpayers billions on our energy bills. In the process, we will put Americans to work in new jobs that pay well and can't be outsourced. Jobs building solar panels and wind turbines, constructing fuel-efficient cars and buildings, and developing the new energy technologies that will lead to even more jobs, more savings, and a cleaner, safer planet in the bargain. To improve the quality of our health care while lowering its costs, we will make the immediate investments necessary to ensure that within 5 years, all of America's medical records are computerized. This will cut waste, eliminate red tape, and reduce the need to repeat expensive medical tests. But it just won't save billions of dollars and thousands of jobs. It will save lives by reducing the deadly but preventable medical errors that pervade our healthcare system. To give our children the chance to live out their dreams in a world that's never been more competitive, we will equip tens of thousands of schools, community colleges, and public universities with 21st century classrooms, labs, and libraries. We'll provide new computers, new technology, and new training for teachers so that students in Chicago and Boston can compete with children in Beijing for the high-tech, high-wage jobs of the future. To build an economy that can lead this future, we will begin to rebuild America. Yes, we'll put people to work repairing crumbling roads, bridges, and schools by eliminating the backlog of well-planned, worthy, and needed infrastructure projects. But we'll also do more to retrofit America for a global economy. That means updating the way we get our electricity by starting to build a new smart grid that will save us money, protect our power sources from blackout or attack, and deliver clean, alternative forms of energy to every corner of our nation. It means expanding broadband lines across America so that a small business in a rural town can connect and compete with their counterparts anywhere in the world. It means investing in the science, research, and technology that will lead to new medical breakthroughs, new discoveries, and entire new industries. And finally, this recovery and reinvestment plan will provide immediate relief to states, workers, and families who are bearing the brunt of this recession. To get people spending again, 95% of working families will receive a $1,000 tax cut. The first stage of a middle-class tax cut that I promised during the campaign and will include in our next budget. To help Americans who have lost their jobs and can't find new ones, we'll continue the bipartisan extension of unemployment insurance and health care coverage to help them through this crisis. Government at every level will have to tighten its belt, but we'll help struggling states avoid harmful budget cuts as long as they take responsibility and use the money to maintain essential services like police, fire, education, and health care. Now, I understand that some might be skeptical of this plan. Our government has already spent a good deal of money, but we haven't yet seen that translate into more jobs or higher incomes or renewed confidence in our economy. And that's why the American Recovery and Reinvestment Plan won't just throw money at our problems. We'll invest in what works. The true test of policies we'll pursue won't be whether they're Democratic or Republican ideas, whether they're conservative or liberal ideas, but whether they create jobs, grow our economy, and put the American dream within the reach of the American people. Instead of politicians doling out money behind a veil of secrecy, decisions about where we invest will be made transparently and informed by independent experts wherever possible. Every American will be able to hold Washington accountable for these decisions by going online to see how and where their taxpayer dollars are spent. And as I announced yesterday, we will launch an unprecedented effort to eliminate unwise and unnecessary spending that has never been more unaffordable for our nation and our children's future than it is right now. We have to make tough choices and smart investments today so that as the economy recovers, the deficits start coming down. We cannot have a solid recovery if our people and our businesses don't have confidence that we're getting our fiscal house in order. And that's why our goal is not to create a slew of new government programs, but a foundation for long-term economic growth. And that also means an economic recovery plan that is free from earmarks and pet projects. I understand that every member of Congress has ideas about how to spend money, and many of these projects are worthy. They benefit local communities. But this emergency legislation must not be the vehicle for those aspirations. This must be a time when leaders in both parties put the urgent needs of our nation above our own narrow interests. Now, this recovery plan alone will not solve all the problems that led us into this crisis. We must also work with the same sense of urgency to stabilize and repair the financial system we all depend on. That means using our full arsenal of tools to get credit flowing again to families and businesses while restoring confidence in our markets. It means launching a sweeping effort to address the foreclosure crisis so that we can keep responsible families in their homes. It means preventing the catastrophic failure of financial institutions whose collapse could endanger the entire economy. But only with maximum protections for taxpayers and a clear understanding that government support for any company is an extraordinary action that must come with significant restrictions on the firms that receive support. And it means reforming a weak and outdated regulatory system so that we can better withstand financial shocks and better protect consumers, investors, and businesses from the reckless greed and risk-taking that must never endanger our prosperity again. No longer can we allow Wall Street wrongdoers to slip through regulatory cracks. No longer can we allow special interests to put their thumbs on the economic scales. No longer can we allow the unscrupulous lending and borrowing that leads only to destructive cycles of bubble and bust. It is time to set a new course for this economy, and that change must begin now. We should have an open and honest discussion about this recovery plan in the days ahead. But I urge Congress to move as quickly as possible on behalf of the American people. For every day we wait or point fingers or drag our feet, more Americans will lose their jobs. More families will lose their savings. More dreams will be deferred and denied. And our nation will sink deeper into a crisis that at some point we may not be able to reverse. That is not the country I know. It is not a future I accept as President of the United States. A world that depends on the strength of our economy is now watching and waiting for America to lead once more. And that is what we will do. It will not come easy or happen overnight. And it is altogether likely that things may get worse before they get better. But that is all the more reason for Congress to act without delay. I know the scale of this plan is unprecedented, but so is the severity of our situation. We have already tried the wait-and-see approach to our problems, and it is the same approach that helped lead us to this day of reckoning. And that is why the time has come to build a 21st century economy in which hard work and responsibility are once again rewarded. That's why I'm asking Congress to work with me and my team day and night, on weekends if necessary, to get the plan passed in the next few weeks. That's why I'm calling on all Americans, Democrats and Republicans and independents, to put good ideas ahead of the old ideological battles, a sense of common purpose above the same narrow partisanship, and insist that the first question each of us asks isn't what's good for me, but what's good for the country my children will inherit. More than any program or policy, it is this spirit that will enable us to confront these challenges with the same spirit that has led previous generations to face down war and depression and fear itself. And if we do, if we are able to summon that spirit again, if we are able to look out for one another and listen to one another and do our part for our nation and for posterity, then I have no doubt that years from now, we will look back on 2009 as one of those years that marked another new and hopeful beginning for the United States of America. Thank you. God bless you. And may God bless the United States of America.
Thank you. President-elect Barack Obama giving a speech this morning at George Mason University and talking about his economic recovery plan, saying that dramatic action is needed, telling his audience if nothing is done, this recession could linger for years. We could lose a generation of potential and promise. Also telling the audience that we have come through an era of profound irresponsibility and laying the blame on Wall Street and on Washington. He said there has been a devastating loss of trust. But then he turned and said we can rebuild that lost trust and confidence if we act with urgency and seriousness. And he knows that the country can achieve greatness again. He also talked about saving or creating 3 million jobs over the next several years, investing in energy and education and new infrastructure, doubling the production of alternative energy in the next 3 years, equipping tens of thousands of schools and universities and community colleges with new labs and computers, and then ending the speech with a call to action for Congress, saying that we must act without delay, even if it means working night and day and over the weekend to get this done. I'm going to bring Charles Franklin, political scientist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, back into our conversation here. But if you're listening in and you'd like to add a bit to the conversation here about what you heard, we'd like to hear it. 800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 online at MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. Click on Send a Question. What do you think about that framework that Barack Obama has just laid out, talking about some sacrifice, too, that will be necessary from the American people? Charles Franklin, this was billed as some specifics on this economic recovery plan. I didn't hear much there.
No, not really. And in part, that may be smart strategy here, that as soon as you lay real details down, those become targets. I think the expansion of information here was very limited. He mentioned things that have been talked about before, public works, construction projects, infrastructure like highways and so on. He also mentioned things like medical information systems, which has been talked about a lot, the investment in schools, libraries, labs, classrooms, and so on. And he talked a little bit about regulation of the financial sector, but none of it, I think, rises to the level of a surprising new area of his agenda. And unless I missed it, I didn't hear any mention of the price of all of this.
No, there was no figure. I was looking for that. Maybe others were, too, but there was no figure. You know, this struck me as as reminiscent of a campaign speech, as if he is still in campaign mode and may think that's necessary to get this package through Congress.
I think that's probably true, and it's also maybe the reality of the situation. At this point, especially when it's still a couple of weeks or 10 days anyway before he becomes president, it's probably not the best idea to lay out a package with every line, even if such a package is together at this point.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting questions to watch how he governs is going to be the extent to which he takes a package to Congress and says, here's what I'm specifically proposing, and this is the base from which you should work. Or whether he leaves more initiative to members of Congress. One of the things we've seen in news coverage in the last day or two are members of both the Senate and the House asserting their right to play an active role in structuring the policy. That's something that President Bush used an awful lot in his administration, of laying out very broad principles but then sitting back and waiting for Congress to shape those policies. I think it's unlikely the Obama administration plays as passive a role with Congress as President Bush did, but I think it's still an open question how much do members of the House and Senate get to design this themselves, as opposed to how much do they react to a specific set of proposals that the Obama administration puts in front of them.
I was wondering, as I was listening to him talk about updating labs and computers at community colleges and schools and universities, if the University of Wisconsin-Madison will be there with with a handout saying, we need some of this money.
We'll see if Wisconsin or Minnesota gets in line first. More seriously on this is an area that obviously I have a parochial interest in, but universities are going to surely line up as examples of spade-ready projects, except in this case, it'll be test tube-ready projects and classroom-ready projects. One of the real issues is, where are investments like that in schools or universities in fact promoting long-term economic recovery, and when are they another form of pork barrel spending that, again, those of us in universities have a real interest in?
Yeah, maybe that's in the eye of the beholder.
Well, I think certainly from the campus's point of view, we have excellent things we would do with the money, but I'm sure that every interest group in America has exactly the same view of it. And one of the real challenges for the administration is that every interest group, every group like universities, but also the auto industry and the financial industry, is sitting here saying, there's going to be $1 trillion new on the table. How do I get my share of that?
No, absolutely.
And the challenge for Congress and the president is how to avoid that becoming the feeding trough for the pork, and how to make good on Obama's claim a minute ago that this is going to be based on programs that work and have demonstrable impacts on employment and investment, rather than things that are driven by ideological, or he didn't say it, but I would say, special interest group efforts.
To the phones to John in St. Paul. John, I know you were listening into that. What'd you want to add to this?
Rather than things that are driven by...
Hi, John, are you there? Uh-oh. John's listening to us, but he is not turning down his radio. We'll see if we can get in touch with him, because I know he was listening to the speech. Charles, an online comment here from a listener who is in Atlanta, Georgia, who heard us talking about the auto bailouts, asking why was there such a rush to push through the mortgage and the auto bailouts, but giving money back to the people was not necessarily that important to Congress. Boy, you heard a lot of that in the days after the election and into early December, as Congress wrestled with these big bailouts. Has some of that faded, do you think, that sense of outrage?
I don't think so, and I think it could come back. One of the interesting parts of the speech today was the mention of $1,000 back to taxpayers. He didn't talk about business taxes, which we've heard talk about in the last day or two, but he did talk about that money back to individuals. The other thing he talked about was a program to limit or end foreclosures. And that was one of the areas that the Atlanta writer is touching on, that for all of the bailout of the financial industry, nothing particular was done for homeowners facing foreclosure. Clearly, Obama has an intention of being involved with that and putting that higher on the agenda.
Let me go to the phones here to Dan in Fridley. Hi, Dan. Hi, Dan. Are you there?
Hello.
Hi. What did you want to add to this?
Hey, I'd like to ask the gentleman there, did the University of Wisconsin, when they talk about pork, how come they pay three times as much per square foot to get a building built in the state of Wisconsin versus a private sector?
I'm afraid that's far beyond my expertise. I have no idea what building costs are.
How about this idea, though, Charles? And
mm-hmm.
we talked a bit about this at the beginning of the hour, or in our last hour, about bringing some kind of accountability back to government spending. I mean, he has hired this government watchdog that he introduced everybody yesterday. My guests seem to think that this was symbolic and perhaps even a gimmick. How much faith do you put in that?
I think that the idea that there's large amounts of waste, fraud, and abuse that's easy to eliminate from the federal budget was tested during the Reagan administration, was found to be remarkably hard to do. Which is not to say there's not enormous amounts of waste, fraud, and abuse, but eliminating it is extremely hard to do. And if Dan's right that government pays more for buildings and things like that, that's an open question about efficiency and how do you deal with it. I think the, you know, ultimately we'll believe Barack Obama about eliminating unnecessary programs when he actually lays out half a dozen or a dozen or 100 programs and says, I want these zeroed out in the next budget. That's the proof of the pudding, and I think we'll wait with considerable skepticism until we see that actually happen.
How do you think his pronouncement that the era of anything goes in Washington is over? Now, we've heard other presidents say this.
Right.
How is that received if you are a member of Congress in Washington or you're even a lobbyist in Washington? What are you hearing about from that?
I think what Obama is trying to do is play to public sentiment, which is remarkably negative towards Congress now, which was directed more at Republicans during their control, but could easily turn into negative views of the Democratic
yeah.
Congress as well.
That's why it seems risky.
And so, well, it's risky on the one hand, but it's also the moment when a president has the opportunity to seize public opinion. If public opinion were really supportive of that view, then I think the president with the bully pulpit can use that to not eliminate congressional parochialism, that'll never go away, but can use it as a forceful tool to put restraints on some congressional control and special interests. Now, the trick, of course, again, coming back to what we said a minute ago, is one person's special interest is another person's deserving project in the public interest. And so in that sense, it's very easy to say bad things about the other guy's special projects and to defend our own very legitimate needs. And
right.
I think that's the every member of Congress sees the spending that goes in their district as being vital to the national interest. In that sense, no president, Democrat or Republican, is ever going to convince members of Congress to forego completely that kind of benefits to their constituents.
Right. No, I mean, no matter what he's saying about, we will apply a new standard of spending and we will ask that everyone ask this question, not what does it do for me, but what does it do for the country?
Right.
You're saying good luck.
It's good rhetoric. But more than rhetoric in the sense that it is the way to bring public opinion to pressure Congress not to load up this recovery bill with large amounts of earmarks for their home districts. But how successfully Obama can do that depends in part on how successfully he can bring the public along with him.
Yeah.
I think he has the advantage right now that public opinion favors that view, that Congress has been out of control, has behaved irresponsibly, and so on. So to that extent, I think he works from a position of strength. But he runs against institutional factors that 435 members are elected from 435 different districts and 50 different states. And there's no way that you overcome that institutional structure at most, maybe you mitigate its effects, or you find ways that the spending that goes into districts is going into districts based on these program priorities that the president is pushing for, rather than idiosyncratic earmarks from the members of those districts.
If you've just joined us, we're talking about some of the themes that were sounded in President-elect Barack Obama's speech from George Mason University this morning in Washington. Now, we were told that there were going to be more specifics about his economic recovery plan. Really, he gave a kind of a broad overview of his thinking as he puts together the plan that his team is coming up with and then works with Congress as they add or subtract the items that they want to add to the plan. And so we got more of a sense of how he's approaching this than specifics about the economic stimulus package that he's working on. He did say, there's a warning perhaps to Congress, that he wants them to act without delay, even if that means day and night and on weekends. He wants the package complete very, very soon. Congress wanted, originally Democrats in Congress, I should say, wanted to have it on his desk by the inaugural day. That is not going to happen now. 800-242-2828 to join us, 651-227-6000 if you have some thoughts about the themes that you heard in the speech, to Dave in Brainerd. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Your guest was talking about Obama maybe just laying out his general plan like President Bush did and letting Congress work it. But this Congress, I would say 85-90% of them have been there for years, and look where we're at. I think we need the leader to lead us and not let the Congress throw stuff in. How many of them are economic people? You know, it's what voice do they really have? What opinion?
Charles, I think that's a great point, that there's a lot of longevity in those chambers. I know there are new members, but there's also a lot of longevity.
No, there certainly is. And the Congress, for all of its change, is still much more stable from year to year than anything else. Let me be clear. I don't think that Obama will necessarily sit passively by and let Congress legislate. I think that was one of the major mistakes of the Bush administration, was that it was far too passive in that. The point I was trying to make is that we don't yet know how much the Obama administration is going to try to put the legislation down in detail and then push Congress to pass it as they wrote it, versus how much they'll work with Congress or perhaps step further back. I think there's every indication that this will be an assertive administration, but it's one where members of Congress are also going to push back. So the members of the Appropriations Committee or the Ways and Means Committee are not going to sit passively and simply pass whatever the president puts in front of them. And so the political challenge for Obama is how to get the things that he wants and get them through Congress without them being gutted or dramatically changed, and yet still maintain a good working relationship between 535 extremely egotistical and self-interested members of Congress.
It's going to be interesting to see how Rahm Emanuel carries out that mission, because he has obviously he has good relationships with the Democratic leadership, but he also has a reputation for being a pretty tough character.
I think the reputation on that side is one that is very hard charging and very tough. I think the key to the Obama administration that we've seen or heard so far is the notion of pragmatism, that if this is an administration which can succeed in arguing for its legislative proposals on the grounds that these are things that a broad range of economists and policy analysts believe will work, I think that's the pragmatic argument that keeps Democrats on his side and wins over at least a few Republicans, or a substantial number of Republicans, to make this a more bipartisan effort. I think within the Democratic Party, there are certainly the so-called blue dog Democrats, the fiscally conservative Democrats, who themselves could be a problem unless the pragmatism and the compelling need for these programs is really strong. And that's the true test of Rahm Emanuel and the legislative team that Obama's putting together, is can they present these things in ways that satisfy the members' need for some input and control, but at the same time make the case so compelling, as the Obama did in his speech today, that if we sit by and do nothing, things will be far, far worse. And implicitly, if that happens, it's you guys in Congress who are
yeah,
making that happen.
Yeah, that's what's not said, but that's definitely what's meant. To Janet in St. Paul. Hi, Janet.
Hello.
Hi. What do you want to comment on?
I would like to ask Congress and the President, I do support a stimulus package, but to step back and do something very basic, and that's give some money very, very quickly to the states for state and local government assistance so that we can keep some of these people who are working and doing important jobs, keep them working and keep them from being laid off, like our teachers and our librarians and our firefighters. And I might add that the United States went through the entire Depression without closing a single public library.
Yeah.
That is not the case anymore.
Janet, it's a good point because the governors have made that point. The mayors are, some of the mayors were in the audience today. I know Mayor Ryback of Minneapolis is out in Washington to press that very point. It sounds like, Charles Franklin, President-elect Obama has heard that.
Yes, I think so. And here in Wisconsin, where we're looking at a $5 billion deficit, that has certainly been on our governor's mind as well. Obama in the speech today said that aid to states would be a central part, provided that the states use that money to maintain essential services, and he mentioned specifically police, fire,
right,
education, and health.
Right.
This is an area where federal investment, federal transfer of money into things like health care, especially Medicaid, health care for the poor, could go a long ways to affect the state's bottom lines. Largest share of almost every state's budget goes to Medicare and health care more broadly for its citizens. So that's an area where federal aid could make a big difference. I think the skeptical view of it would be any money from the feds that comes into the states is simply relieving the states of the responsibility of dealing with their own fiscal problems. And
well,
I think
well,
that's the danger that conservatives in particular will see in this kind of federal aid.
Do you mean then the money comes in and states use it to plug these big deficits like Minnesota and Wisconsin have, or what?
I think the concern would be that Wisconsin, the state that I know well, has a structural deficit that hasn't been dealt with in 10 or 15 years.
Ah, I see.
And federal money that now alleviates the current emergency merely takes the pressure off and allows the state to continue not addressing the fundamental problems with our state spending. Now, of course, as a resident of Wisconsin, I'd be happy to have some federal money that relieves our budget.
Because you don't want your property taxes going
exactly,
up, is that true?
Exactly. And so, as everybody, I want the money to be paid by somebody else, not by me. But that's exactly the difficulty that every state, and for that matter the federal government, faces. No one wants to pay for the programs that we all want to consume. And so federal money that alleviates the state's short-term problems can certainly help get us through the current financial recession and crisis that's going with it. But the danger is it will create more state dependence on that federal money. And, of course, the federal money also comes from us, the taxpayers, or from our grandchildren who are saddled with our debts.
Let's hear from Sean in Cambridge. Hi, Sean. Thanks for waiting.
No problem. I was just trying to draw a relation between Obama's speeches recently. I mean, it seems like every other day he's got another speech or another media blitz going out there with the FDR fireside chat, and the fact that, I mean, it's really right now the fear of our nation is not really being shown. We've got a global economy right now that's suffering. I mean, we've got revolution in China. We've got the actual economy. I guess what I was trying to say was just basically drawing this as his speech is coming off as just trying to show the American people that, oh, you know, it's okay. It's okay. We're going to be all right.
Sean, your phone is so noisy here. I think we've got the essence of what you were going to say. And let me add to this, Charles, we're hearing from Patrick in Minneapolis, who says The one thing that really struck me was the FDR undertones near the end of the speech. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. I think Sean was hearing that as well. Do you?
Exactly. And I think two things are going on. One is, as any new president would do, trying to develop an image and a connection with the American people on these broad consensual notions that we're a strong nation, that we're in tough times, but we'll recover. And at the end of the speech, he said, we're a country that in the past has faced down war, faced down depression, and faced down fear itself, the allusion to Roosevelt. The other thing that's going on here is the vacuum of leadership from the Bush administration. President Bush's approval rating has been so low for so long, and he was so overshadowed for the last 12 months, at least, with the election campaign, that there's just little that the White House today can do from President Bush's perspective. And therefore, President-elect Obama has stepped in to fill that vacuum at an unusually early time in his transition. And I think he's using these very short but very frequent press conferences or speeches to help develop that or fill that vacuum that's normal in a transition, but seems to be exacerbated in the current case.
And Charles, I have just a couple minutes left, but I don't want to close without asking you about that extraordinary picture that was released yesterday, video and photographs of all of the living presidents, former presidents, president-elect, standing together on, I think it was the steps of the White House. Did you see it?
Yes, and it's a remarkable moment. One really would like to have been the fly on the wall at their at their dinner. I thought Obama did one very interesting thing. He was asked, what will you learn from the mistakes of these people? And his response immediately was, I'm going to learn from their successes, which was not only very diplomatic, but in a more serious and fundamental way, says, how do you learn to govern? And one way is by looking at other people's successes and not just their failures.
And when you look at the arc of history in that group of presidents, and you think of all of the things that occurred during their collective terms, I think in some ways it gives you a sense that, yes, things look dark and rather dire at the moment, but you see what they handled, and you get the sense that there's a continuum here, and you know, the country will endure.
Well, certainly that's the case. And the person that wasn't there was Ronald Reagan, who in many ways is more like Obama in terms of the situation. He came in with a president, Jimmy Carter, who had suffered major financial problems, major energy problems, a major international crisis. And the Reagan administration saw the economy fall for two straight years after that. It was only after 1982 that the economy turned around, and then Reagan could run for re-election in 84 saying it's morning again in America. Barack Obama's in a similar situation both domestically and internationally and may very well face the next 2 years of suffering economic performance. And the question for him is, can he, like Reagan, see the country coming back in the third and fourth years of his term? And can he, like Reagan, help the country retain some sense of optimism even as the next year or two shows further economic decline?
We'll talk again, I know. Charles, thank you. Always a pleasure.
Always fun. Thank you.
Charles Franklin is a political scientist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, providing some perspective to us today in the wake of President-elect Barack Obama's speech at George Mason University. More coverage about it this afternoon on All Things Considered. This is Mid-Morning.
This is Geralyn Steele, and I'm getting ready for a six-concert statewide tour. It's part of Minnesota Public Radio's Troubadour program. Now, I'll be jumping around the state from Brainerd to Rochester and from Duluth to Windham. The grand finale is Saturday night, April 25th, at the Fitzgerald Theater. Oh, I can't wait to see you as I sing many of the great songs that I've performed on A Prairie Home Companion. To find out more, just go to MinnesotaPublicRadio.org and click events.
Support for this program comes from the Women's Foundation of Minnesota, a community foundation growing equality for women and girls through philanthropy, grant-making, research, and advocacy. When women and girls move forward, the world moves with them. WFMN.org.
And you're listening to Minnesota Public Radio.